That Roger Waters show, I wish that I had tape of the audio cut-up that played for about 5 to 10 minutes before they started the show. Were you in the audience to hear that, David?
Yeah.
One of my biggest regrets, not regrets, but one of the things that I wish I could always go back in time to see was Lenny Bruce. He's one of my favorites of all time. He is the Ketter point of American comedy. Everything descends from his brilliance. I mean, he was the one who put it all together. Anyways, I'm sitting there stoned in the United Center, and all of a sudden I hear Lenny Bruce. And I'm hearing Lenny Bruce in a 15,000 seat, you know, arena, and it's just like a little dream come true, because it's just one of those little things that you just sort of meditate upon. And then I realized this whole 10-minute thing that I'm listening to is a structure. It's not just some random shit. I mean, Roger Waters or his team put this together. Mm-hmm. And then as I start looking around the arena, little things started to pop out that seemingly were random, which all of a sudden became clearly planted in the audience. There was a beggar with a shopping cart.
Yep.
Walking around. Did you see that?
Yeah.
It was something I didn't see until I connected what the audio was. And it was just, I recognized all of a sudden in that moment just how orchestrated a performance this was going to be.
Yep.
It was really brilliant. I mean, it was a 2.5 hour show that flew by in the blink of an eye. And this is before all of my work with The Wall and Kubrick and everything. So I don't know which, you know, it's one of those nice connections to the totality of everything. But if you ever get a chance to see it, Alan, it's something.
Oh, no, that sounds incredible. What do you, I'm curious, what was, like, when you said about the beggar with the shopping cart, what do you think the significance of that was?
It was just Roger Waters, and how do I say this? It was probably something that you, just like a beggar on the street, you can walk by and never notice. And there was this beggar in the United Center pushing a shopping cart that I'm sure, which you should notice, right? It's out of place. It's in an environment it should never be. And it was playing itself as if it was real to some extent. And I'm sure that a lot of people down there on the floor in the expensive seats didn't even see again. Like, there's things outside that you choose not to see. And even put inside this theater, which is supposedly entertainment, and you're still blind to it.
Can I ask you a question? Since we're, you know, like, because we had just been talking about Labyrinth, and then you said about the beggar with the shopping cart. I don't know, my mind went to that scene in the movie Labyrinth where there's the old woman who's carrying all the, like, baggage, basically. And she's like, oh, here, you need this, take this with you. I don't know why, but sort of that's where my mind went. But now I'm thinking the idea of the people in the expensive seats are basically on the floor. Would that not be that they're in the labyrinth and the people in the cheap seats are the ones above? Do you...
Wow, that's an inversion, man.
Yeah, no, that was my thought during it, actually. That's completely where I was at with it. Because I was looking at it, and we were above, and we're looking down. I'm like, that's a beggar. And I'm like, this is like, oh, the fucking echelon gets to go out to the show. You know, so you thought you'd like to go out to the show to feel the warm, mellow confusion, that space cadet glow, you know, and they're all out there to be all sophisto, and then someone is coming up to them and asking for help. You know, it was just, it was perfect, you know. And then also that the whole thing, more than the film used to be, but like huge emphasis on government control, and there's two simultaneous realities. He's like, tear down the wall, because as long as everyone's separated, there's no possibility for peace. But as long as we're looking for a new world order where we're under constant surveillance, there's this whole theme of surveillance that went throughout the show with the fucking eye watching everybody. It was like, how? It was like, oh, we see you. you know, and they kept on fucking pushing this whole government thing. It was like, mother, should I trust the government? And all of a sudden it's like, fuck no, across the wall, you know, and it's just like, you know, and it's this whole thing. And so I felt like they were kind of showing that we imitate the echelon. So lower class imitates the echelon, and that's what keeps the echelon in power. If we didn't imitate, it wouldn't be happening. If everyone wasn't out to get theirs the same way people above and the people above do, we wouldn't probably be in the situation that we're in, because there is no upper pyramid without the base complying with the same mirrored dynamics. And so I felt like his whole point is like, we need to end the separation, but not in the way of one nation or a few nations dominating the rest of the world through their fucking massive military strength. You know, it's more than that. And so it's a prayer in many ways. The whole thing is like a ceremony prayer in what he wants to see come out of this, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was church at its finest, man. And I saw people in the stands who, like a pilgrimage, like this was the biggest night of their year, and some of them for their lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was, and what was odd was how most of the people in my section were at intermission or right before were walking to their seats with just bags and handfuls of merchandise, you know, trying to keep a piece of this experience forever, literally, because it was going to be gone tomorrow, but they'd have their shirt. And they'd have their poster, and they were, it was like the collection plate or something, I don't know, but they were dropping tons of money. And just the difference of the church experience for the people on the rafters were dropping all this dough, but then the people on the floor probably weren't buying the shitty sweatshirt or the commemorative poster. I don't know, I mean, everything that was going on stage was happening in the crowd. It was a unbelievable spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
I had gotten pretty upset with the concert going experience, because there were so many times where there would be, and I don't think it's an age thing or it's a yuppie thing. I don't even think so. But where I would go to concerts and there would be people who, like, you stand up in your seat and then people would be like, "Hey, sit down, I can't see." Why are you sitting? Like, this is not a passive experience. Or just, you know, I remember the first concert I went to where it was in Madison Square Garden, I think, or maybe the one across the river in Jersey. I don't know, they called the Continental Airlines Arena. I don't know what it is now. But Meadowlands Continental Airlines Arena. But a guy came around, you know, like you might have at a baseball game, like some guy come around selling hot dogs.
Mm-hmm.
They had a guy coming around selling champagne and strawberries. And I was like, I remember the first time I saw that, I'm like, what the fuck is that? And then I started seeing it more and more. And I was like, what the fuck is this? This is not a rock concert, you know? And I almost got thrown out of, I saw Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
They had Booker T and the MGs, the drummer from Crazy Horse. Really, really good show.
Yeah.
And I'm there for like 5 minutes, and they start out with Wooden Ships, and the first fucking song, me and my friends stand up, I'm like, yeah, you know, whatever.
And no one's fucking doing anything.
No one's doing anything. And the people behind us are like, can you sit down? Can you sit down? And
I experienced the same exact thing at the same concert. Yeah, in Sacramento. Went out there.
And I was like, no, I'm not going to sit down. And then people two rows back started throwing popcorn at us. Sit down, sit down. And they took ice cubes out of their soda. And I didn't even know they were throwing us because they weren't hitting us. So apparently they were throwing stuff at us to sit down. And I'm like, no, I'm not sitting down. So they were throwing stuff. They hit somebody else. They hit some guy's girlfriend. He gets up and he's like, hey, what the fuck are you doing? You know, and then security comes over. And all this thing, I'm like, I'm just trying to watch this concert. And security comes over and I'm like, sir, we're going to have to ask you to leave. And I'm like, what, excuse me? I'm like, yeah, you're disturbing the experience for the other concert goer. I'm like, I'm just standing. I'm trying to enjoy the music. You know, like, well, you have to sit down. Why should I have to sit down? Like, this is a concert. And basically, like, well, you know, now that this guy got into this fight, it's causing too much of a thing. So basically what he says is, like, he goes, you have a choice. You can either sit here or you can go behind the stage where you can stand and do whatever you want.
Jesus.
So I was like, they weren't great seats. So I was like, you know, whatever. The people just around me sucked so bad. I was like, all right, let me just try. But can I, like, can I see the space behind the stage? And he's like, sure. Went behind the stage. Everyone's drunk and stoned and having a great time and standing up. And I was actually really close to the stage. So I'm like, yes, I will stay here. Thank you. And
awesome. Yeah, I danced the whole time. I think I embarrassed my dad, but I didn't really care. I went with my dad, you know. And I was just like, whatever, dude. Like, everyone was so uptight. I was like, what is this fucking Sophisto shit? You guys realize, like, what this came out of? Like, oh, God. It was weird, you know. Yeah. Anyways.
And that was the music from your dad's time.
Yeah, my dad was a huge Neil Young fan. He got every Neil Young record on vinyl. Yeah. So I was just thinking about the gladiator thing with Spartacus in relationship to your King Kill 33 I don't know, fascination or interest, I guess would be the word. Being that one of the things that's presented from the Golden Bough, the anthropological book, is that the whole gladiator thing came out of the killing of the king with taking the sacred mistletoe and challenging the king and then marrying the king's daughter if you were to kill the king and take on the throne. And it was a fool and a slave who would do it. And so Spartacus is a slave who, you know, it's just, it all kind of fits really, really succinctly. So it was just coming up. So
no, that's, I understand completely. It's funny, I've actually been rereading The Golden Bough all week. So yeah, I totally get that reference. And
how does this relate to, I'm going to bring Mike Tyson into this. You know, he was the last of the Titans, for lack of a better term right now. When he was in his prime, he was as dominant and untouchable of a, I mean, the king of boxing. No one was going to touch that motherfucker, right? And then they throw some fool into the ring with him, Buster Douglas, and he knocks out the king. And Mike Tyson never recovered from that.
Wasn't Don King his promoter?
It was. Don King was his
promoter. Don King, yep.
And that was the downfall of his career when he moved into Don King's corner, because he used to have a Sal D'Amato, the guy who raised him, got him off the street and turned him into the fighting machine that he was, and then he got so big and got so much money that he jumped into Don King's sort of partnership and cut his ties with Sal D'Amato, and next thing you know, some chump, literally some buster, comes into the ring in Japan and knocks him out. And, you know, what should have happened, or what does happen in the Golden Bough stories, is that the king only dies because the challenger is greater. The challenger doesn't get lucky, you know what I mean?
No, not by
Well, actually, there's a chapter about when the king is infirm, or like any sign of imperfection in the king, there are like these cultures where they would actually tell the king, like, okay, you have to kill yourself now. Like,
right, and he would kill himself with a fucking different ways, but sometimes with a knife in front of the whole fucking village, you know, or whatever, you know. He'd stab himself to death and everyone would watch.
So the idea, I just wanted to throw that out there, is the idea that the idea of someone being greater, it could also be that he was weak because he had fallen into the trap of thinking he was so great or something like that.
That goes right into The Hangover, right? The Hangover is America going to Vegas and falling into Sin City, and waking up with a Mike Tyson tattoo on their face in Hangover 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like essentially that I'm thinking it's unbeatable and waking up, what the fuck happened? You know? We're you know how you have young Elvis and fat Elvis? They didn't wake up in the morning as young Mike Tyson. They woke up in the morning as old Mike Tyson. It's that the challenger to America wasn't a stronger, better challenger to the throne. It was that the king became infirm and fell on its sword or something.
No, I think that's I didn't know that that happened in Japan, because when you said he falls in the ring in Japan, what I immediately think of is the movie Contact, where she, to me, Contact is just essentially a remake of 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yep.
And they even say that everyone, the entire production crew watched 2001 A Space Odyssey in, yes, Donkey King Kong, that's awesome. the entire production crew watched 2001 A Space Odyssey in unison. So you have this, but realize it doesn't happen at Cape Canaveral, which of course Cape Canaveral is the Kennedy Space Center, so you have the Kennedy King kill. No, instead they have to go to Japan. And literally, the machine that she uses for the Stargate is she falls into the ring. And to me, the Stargate is and a king kill are the same thing. This is what I'm trying to show.
Dude, snap. That's so good. It's because it's the rings, too. They're spinning rings. It's like an Olympics.
Fall into the rings, yeah.
And it's the fucking Lord of the Rings. One ring to rule them all. That's so good. Oh, God. That's scary.
Even you wrote Donkey King Kong. Donkey Kong. No, Donkey Kong. Mario literally has to bring the towers down to kill the king. He literally, there's different stages of King Kong, and in like the second round, Mario has to knock the support system out, and it knocks the tower down and brings the king down. But what something a conversation I had with Michael from Gosporn a while back was everyone has this idea of the Twin Towers is the Temple of Solomon. Well, you have a temple on the right side of your brain, and you have a temple on the left side of your brain. So the bringing down the temples is the king kill. It's the ego death. It is literally that. So the Stargate and the king kill are the same thing.
Right, which ties back to Babel, because that was... So me and William recently, in our last talk, I was tripping out on... basically, the Tower of Babel, once again, Babylonian squares, you lay one in the other, it's all mathematical code that has to do, apparently, with space-time dynamics and how to take in energy or whatever. But what's interesting is that in the Bible as well, when you have... So David wants to build his temple, which ends up being built by Solomon, who's his son. But he's told by Adonai that the temple is not to be built with human hands, that it's a temple on another plane, and we're all building this temple. This is something that's happening, okay? And he's like, okay, I respect that. I get it. Don't build it. His son goes and builds the Temple of Solomon. So then flash forward way further into the text most likely written by Josephus Flavius and a group of Roman intellectuals called the Gospel Story. You have Jesus turns over the money tables at the temple. And it's like, this isn't for trade. This isn't for trade and the temple. Two different things. Okay? Okay, flash forward way the fuck into the future. Rome supposedly falls, but really the Roman Catholic Church owns more property in the world and is still more powerful than it ever was. And we have America builds its representative of the temple as the World Trade Center with the two columns and the fucking holiest of holies in the center that they rotate to be similar to the Kaaba at Mecca, which is the cube, which is the spot of the Kaaba in Mecca is where Abraham was going to kill his son Isaac and was stopped by Metatron. And so you have Metatron's cube. We build a giant fucking cube in the place where Metatron was supposed to have stopped Abraham from sacrificing his child or whatever. And then it gets complicated because then there's the fucking tefillin. And when you do the Jewish, cleansing prayer of Adonai, Adahenu, Adonai, Echad, you know, you basically put a cube on your forehead. Anyways, I'm going down a tangent here, but...
No, that's it. Yeah, you're putting... Because the real temple was in the mind, so you put the cube on the head and say... And you're literally... When you put that cube on your head, if you could imagine... Because it goes, like, essentially where the third eye is, for all intents and purposes. Mm-hmm. If you can imagine your two temples rising up from that, you literally have your World Trade Center, you know, the temple there... The two temples with the cube in the center.
Right. And so the cube, you have one on your arm and one on your head. They contain a scroll that the front of the scroll actually reads Shaddai. It's Shin, Dalet, Yud. And its value is 341 in Hebrew Gematria. What I found interesting is I had just recently done Tefillin, with my rabbi, I was watching The Matrix Reloaded. For whatever reason, my girlfriend was like, I want to watch Matrix Reloaded. And I was like, okay, cool. And I'm sitting there. And they're like, how long does he have in the room with the architect? The architect is, you know, Metatron is referred to as the architect. But anyways, he has 3 minutes and 14 seconds to be in the room to discuss with the architect. 314. It's the value of Shaddai, which is the fucking cube, which connects to the Kaaba, which connects to Metatron. It's all like boom, boom, boom. There's actually a verse in the Torah that says, basically, to be aware that Shaddai has, or that Metatron has my name. And it's like, how does Metatron have Adonai's name? It's God. God's like, Metatron has my, it's like, his angel has his name, the angel's Metatron. Like, how is that so? And it's because the value in Gematria of Metatron is the same value as Shaddai. It's 314. That's my thought.
3.14 is pi.
3.14, and then you have pi. And then you have, in the film pi, he does tefillin. Yes. And says the prayer right before the fucking whole revelation. Like,
yeah. Lenny Bruce made a joke once about an old Hasidic Jew getting busted by the cops doing tefillin, and they thinking he's shooting up narcotics.
Because it's his arm. Because he's wrapping it around his arm. Yeah.
Now, how do you actually pronounce that? Because, Bill, when you said it, it sounds like to fill him in, which it's like, you know, basically being... Yeah, to fill him... But I'm just saying, like, as a sort of play on the words, it sounded like, you know, you're being full of the spirit, essentially, or...
Uh-huh, yeah. And Phil from fucking Groundhog's Day from your fucking tarot post.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
If you guys,
that's one of the best posts I've ever read in my life.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I love that one.
How long did that whole narrative or that whole structure hit you? Was that something you worked on for a month or 2 months, or was it just a whirlwind?
In all fairness, so like Mask of God, we have multiple people posting. So I did that sort of top section of... just laying out the structure of Groundhog Day as the tarot and sort of like with the different elements of the woodchuck guidebook and stuff like that. And then Jason added a bunch of stuff, then I added a bunch of stuff, and it gets to a point where we would label whenever someone added, and now we don't. So it's hard to say who's adding.
I really like that.
But I would figure it was probably mostly me and Jason, I think, who did that post. But there could have been other contributions, in all fairness. I saw the movie, and I'm just like, wait a second. So I just... which, bear in mind, I almost did a similar post the other day, was I watched Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And Pee-wee's Big Adventure seems... I would actually argue, again, explicitly, intentionally. So then I was almost like, well, okay, so here's another person who did it intentionally. Do I really need to point it out? But it follows the steps of the 22 Trumps as well. The Pee-wee's Big Adventure starts out, he's on a bicycle with the number zero on his back. He's in like this fantasy bicycle race, but he's number zero. And it literally starts with him as zero. And I'm like, wait a second. So right away, I'm like, I wonder. And then it follows all these different steps. I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And then he actually goes into a tarot shop to get a card reading.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, you know what? It's probably intentional. Like, to me, some, like, the reason I didn't do the post, I wondered with Groundhog Day, it kind of seemed intentional, but I wasn't sure. And then Jason found the data that they, an earlier version of the script, they had the idea that this was a curse placed on Phil by an ex-girlfriend who uses a Hanged Man tarot card. If that's the case, if an earlier version of the script had a tarot card in it, I'm assuming that means this is intentional structure here. And right. It actually took a little of the magic out of it for me. So with PB's Big Adventure, once I realized it was intentional, I was like, well, I could write about it, because it's still interesting in its own right. But for me, I just, I'm so interested in the sinks of, like, all right, obviously this certain structure is intentional, but I'm always more impressed by the unintentional connections.
But you don't have to take a position one way or the other, and you just write the information and you let it speak for itself. Like,
oh yeah,
be the best to go about it. Because the thing is this shit happens on its own in the first place. That there are archetypes and these things do play out, and there is a high degree of that. And there's people who are aware of that, can play with it all they want to, because no one can ever say any definite, they can't take any definite position on it because there's no way to prove. All you have is an accumulation of nodes, and you have enough nodes, and then it could be argued that you have the probability is just out of the park, you know. But then even then, there's still no way, because people will accept it if they believe it or not, you know. So it's always worth exploring, you know.
I think that's an excellent point, and I want to thank you, because you've said that a few times recently, and I have to keep reminding myself of that, because, I don't know, I guess it's a sort of mind trap to an extent, but I played with the idea of, like, well, okay, like, ultimately, I think it doesn't matter if it's intentional or not. We could still, if we zoom out, that we're looking at the full game board, if you will, once you zoom out, the intentional and unintentional, it doesn't matter. But for whatever reason, I still like to distinguish between them to say, like, well, this I think is intentional, this I think is unintentional, and then let's zoom out. But I like your approach, which is just lay the data out. You know, come to whatever conclusion you want, just lay the data out. And I really do appreciate that.
Yeah, the Pink Floyd sinks are one thing. Like, I look at that, and I'm like, there's a lot, they accumulate, and it gets to the point where, like, okay, there's something to this. You start the same album, slightly different timing, and then you see that things will align, but not like they do from this timing. Check it again, you know, for real. And so, the Manson sinks, I cannot fucking possibly fathom how that could be unintentional. So, Antichrist Superstar and Jesus Christ Superstar and Hollywood and Holy Mountain, and, you know, that's just... it's just so blatant, you know, and I don't see how it could be otherwise. But that's not usually the case. Like, usually I'm like, it could go either way. I'm open to either, you know, generally pretty equally, you know. So,
Bill, do you take a position with the Kubrick Transformer?
Well, I just put up this little paragraph from Divine Invasion by Philip K. Dick.
Mm-hmm.
And he discusses this holographic Bible. And depending on a position you take, you can see the totality of all of the knowledge within it, and you can see it expressed as colors. And I think we have to understand just how enveloped we are in this holographic structure, right?
This is the quote you put into the Skype?
Yeah.
This is fantastic. So I'm sorry, I was reading it. Say it again. Where is this from?
This is from the Divine Invasion.
Okay.
In the Divine Invasion, the character in the first chapter brings up Finnegan's Wake, and he types in some lines of Finnegan's Wake, or he recites them to a robot, and the robot goes, "You're fucking crazy."
Yeah.
And what he says is, "I'm not. You're calling James Joyce crazy, one of the greatest artists of our time." He goes, "Explain to me why James Joyce talked about talk tapes before a tape recorder was even invented. Explain to me why characters are sitting around a television set in a novel finished in 1939. Not that these things weren't emergent or in some fashion existent, but he puts them into such a prominent position, and it's sort of saying, James Joyce wasn't crazy. He was tapped into a non-local radio broadcast that defines our present moment, our past moment, but curiously, the future creeps in to the structure of the prose, right? So Philip K. Dick then, in the course of this novel, describes a school where every student is given a computer tablet that asks them questions, and the student will type in the answers, and then the tablet will ask them a new question. So this is just an iPad, and he's just saying that this is the structure of education in the future. But then he goes in to discuss this holographic Bible, and that basically the Christian Islamic Church, which is one of the ruling entities in his novel, they don't like it because they want to freeze scripture. They don't want you to have the ability to look at it from all the infinitude of angles. They would like to pick a position, freeze it, and then make that the gospel, you know? They want to freeze time into a linear timeline. And what this kid is doing in through his relationship with Elias, who is Elijah, is he has access to the divine technology. And basically, I feel like, to some extent, you know, I've read this book, I first read this book 15 years ago, you know, what the Kubrick Transformer is a very archaic or a very simple model of that, where you overlay three distinct books, if you will, and then you look through them all at the same time. And through your perspective and how much of your own experience and your own information you bring to the table, the more you see in it. So that if you spend more time listening to the wall, then when you go and look at the Kubrick Transformer, you get more information out of 2001 and The Shining.
I have a question for you, William.
Yeah.
When you called it the Kubrick Transformer, were you considering that the Transformer film that came out centers around the cube, which is called, referred to in the film as the seed of life, and how Kubrick is cube brick, and how you could take him in a sense as the cuboid, and that he's also the architect of his films, and so he's just like Metatron and Metatron's cube, the architect, or was that coincidence?
That's coincidence. I went to a guy named Maurice Cotterell. He did a book, The Tutankhamun Prophecies, and he has this theory of the Mayan Transformers. There's this jade mask that when scanned, and then taking both scans of this jade mask and you overlay them on top of each other, and then as you rotate them, different archetypal images emerge. It's fascinating. So
send it Jake Coates' way right now with the video he just came out of the Green Heart.
Well, it's...
it's just appropriate in that.
Yeah,
there was... Sorry, there was a... I don't know, about a month or two ago, there was a discovery in a temple in Mexico, which was the Temple of the Sun, and they discovered this hidden chamber, and in it they found this green mask. And I did a post on Mask of God called The Green Mask and connected it to Jim Carrey's mask and all that sort of stuff. But what I thought was most interesting about it was the idea of the green mask being at the center of the temple of the sun, you know, set the controls for the heart of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know about this Tutankhamun prophecy, this other idea. Like, I played with other ideas of what this green mask could mean, but...
You know, the set the controls for the heart of the sun, saucer full of secrets, is one of those really incredible syncs with the specific the dark crystal. And the dark crystal centers around the Great Conjunction, which is a reference to most likely the Saturn-Jupiter reoccurring conjunctions. And so then that relates to King Kill 33, because we've seen either an assassination attempt or an assassination with every... Jupiter Saturn conjunction every time that's come around, and also the shift of the ages itself, sometimes good, sometimes bad, you know, from Agra in the Dark Crystal, who has the clockwork of the planetary spheres all set up, you know, in this huge
the clockwork orange. What I was thinking is conjunction junction, what's your major malfunction?
That's good. All right. Oh, 1, 2, 3, 7.
Thing with the Philip K. Dick, though, with Finnegan's Wake, which is just, I really realized that at the heart of all my obsession with this stuff is Finnegan's Wake. And learning how to transform it. You know the whole image of Pink Floyd with the white light hitting the prism and then the rainbow of colors?
Sure.
No, what is that?
So the when you first gaze upon the text of Finnegan's Wake, it is just a straight line of letters that are untranslatable into anything in your brain. And it's almost impossible to read. Most people say, I read like two pages, then I just had to put it down. You know, it's information going into the brain, but nothing is being translated. It just shuts down the brain, right? So the construction of a prism or the angling of your mind to the 42nd degree that you need so that all of a sudden those words or those lines of text all of a sudden blossom into something holographic. Whereas you are in Dublin in 1921, but then you are also in, 500 years earlier, but then you're also 500 years in the future. That if you're able to prepare and educate your mind and take the right position, then that text of Finnegan's Wake will, that's a stargate. You will see that light show and it will abduct you and you will be inside that book. But it takes a real skilled technician to be able to do that. And the thing that I've been thinking lately is, how do you know if someone understands Finnegan's Wake? They read Finnegan's Wake. That you see them literally spending hours with the book. Now, I have the book Finnegan's Wake, and it's been with me for years, but I'm just starting to actually read it, which to me is, I don't know, it's, a lot of people can say that they're, oh, yeah, I understand Finnegan's Wake, I get it, but they're not using it.
I think you're saying like the idea of like applying it,
that you actually step into it.
Yeah,
that it is it's a place. I mean, it is your brain. It's like when you, it's like the two mirrors. It's like if you get the angles just correct, then you see infinity, reflection upon reflection, reflection. That it is a technology. It is not literature. It is, I don't know. It obviously, it's a work in progress, which I love, is what Joyce always called it for the 17 years in which he was writing it. And I would almost say that, you know, the internet and computers right now are a work in progress, that this technology, we're working on rough drafts of it still. I don't know. I kind of went on a tangent there.
This whole fucking conversation has been kind of a tangent. That's fine.
So I think the Transformer then becomes sort of the first, I don't know, fruit that I plucked from the tree of Finnegan's Wake. That I was able to take something out of Finnegan's Wake and say, here, look at it. This is what is inside there. This is what you're able to... There's a garden in there, and I've got something out of it. So I can get more people to watch that, and I get them to take the years and hours of time to actually read five pages of Finnegan's Wake.
So yeah, I want to see if I can track down this person. I have a friend of a friend who's been memorizing Finnegan's Wake for like the last like 15 years or something. And they've been doing it chapter by chapter. They have they're doing presentations of chapters at a time from their own memory. I need to see if I can find out where they're at.
But you know that whole thing of McKenna says, you can't step in the same river twice. And then he goes, but really, you can't even step in the same river once. Finnegan's Wake, you know, is it the dream of HCE, or is it the dream of ALP, of Ann Olivia, of the river? I think it is the dream of the river, because every time you step into the wake, you never step into the same wake twice or even once, because it is the relationship between your own brain and the wake in that moment of time that defines it.
Right, I think that there's a whole limited view of films and books in the first place that you're like, oh, have you read that? But then the way that we receive something is always our own. And it's like almost a denial of what we ultimately are when we take it from such a limited perspective in the first place. And so if you have a writer or a director or whatever that's looking to push that reflection back to us of what's actually taking place, people have resistance to that acknowledgement. And people get tried and killed over people's perceptions that have nothing to do with fucking reality all the time. I mean, we go through our lives judging everything as if our perception was the reality, you know? That's a big issue, you know, and artists that try and push that realization and do a good job at it are really great. I'm glad that happens.
I think that most pop music then is this disposable pop music that has no shelf life, is that it's just a little crumpled up piece of paper. I mean, there's nothing to go into. It sort of hits you and bounces off and then it dies.
Well, I think that that was kind of the point of that, even in the midst of whatever, you can find the archetypes, and that we play this shit out all the time. And you have certain artists who are aware of those archetypes and go the next level with their creativity to express them in their own ways and unveil a lot of what's already happening. And even like terrible pop musicians and fucking total C movies and B movies like will end up expressing these archetypes unconsciously because they're all there. Somebody who's more adept, on the other hand, knows how to play with those cards, you know.
I have a hesitation there because, excuse me, again, it comes back to the idea of intentional and unintentional. I don't mean to go that route with it, but...
Oh, it's huge. Pivotal.
When, I don't know why I'm getting an echo here. When Jason Barrera, I had a conversation with him about the idea of art where it's intentional and the artists understand the archetypes they're playing with. And his thing is that there is a specific narrative that's supposed to be being laid out. I don't know where that's coming from. Sorry. That's kind of distracting. that if they knew it correctly, they could tell the story. And yeah. I have a little hesitation to that because I think there's that's where you have room for dogma. I think what we have to do, the next step, is the cut-up. And to, if you could understand the archetypes, but instead of telling the story, reshape it and see if there is new forms of that story. So I think it's one thing to understand the archetypes, but I think there's also a temptation to, oh, okay, well, these archetypes seem to be telling this story, so that's the story I'm going to tell, just in a fictionalized version. But okay. We don't want to get stuck in a feedback.
I might be wrong, but from what I've gathered, I've never spoken with Jason directly, but what I've gathered from looking at his work is he seems like he would probably be willing to express that you can have an overarching story with stories within that story.
Yeah.
That's like one of the fundamentals in Kabbalah, is that you have these dynamics of the vacuum that are rather complex and, in a sense, a story, if you want to apply the cards from the European aspect or take on it, you know, that you, the major arcana especially are playing out this story. And it is the story, but within every one of those is a story within a story. And it actually is more of a fractal. And even like, look at like old Kabbalistic texts, and they're like describing a fucking fractal, because they're like, there's a tree, there's a tree within every spherot. And then there's a tree within every spherot of every tree in that spherot. And it just goes on forever. And they're very direct about that. And they're like, what are you describing? You're describing a fractal. And first of all, the geometry that's actually being given when you map it out is the thing is, first of all, described what it is now, broken apart, how it's meant to be folded together, and what you end up with when you do that, which is a perfect vector metric. Every line within the figure is the same length. And so however you divide it, it ends up with its automatic compensation, which immediately ties it to the I Ching. And then you're like, well, you know, the I Ching is 64 hexagrams in a circle, each one with its complement takes, you know, 64 tetrahedrons to form an isotropic vector metric, which is the ideal shape of perfect vector geometry that we've come up with, you know, in geometry. And then you apply that to physics, and it's just, it's huge. It's fundamental and it's foundational. And so it's like, well, were these people in communication? And it's like, maybe, you know, either way, in a sense, what they're describing is the story. Because whether or not they're getting it from each other, or whether or not they're getting it on their own, if it really was the story, they wouldn't need to get it from each other. And that, I think, is the point.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. I mean, this is when a lot of times I see the conspiracy crowd, who I have, you know, one foot in at all times. But... but I will often see, you know, people say like, ah, oh, well, you can see, look, this movie uses Kabbalistic imagery. Ah, this one uses, you know, this Freemasonic symbol, or, you know, whatever you see people talking about. It's like, these guys, in my opinion, were doing what we're doing. They were trying to map out the fractal nature of the universe. And I would argue the Kabbalists did a very good job of it. And a lot of these guys did a very good job of it. And that's just it, is if they're able to essentially be fractal cartographers, then of course we're going to find, if we're digging for something and we come across the same imagery, it doesn't mean that some priest from that school planted it. It could just mean that they were very successful as fractal cartographers, and therefore we're going to find that same symbol set or same archetype in everything.
Right. Well, if it really was a universal archetype, then that's what we'd expect.
Correct. That's been my argument. And I think it's, again, this is why I said, like, there is this, of course, someone could intentionally insert it. Someone, whether it's an artist or whomever that's aware of what they're playing with, they could intentionally insert it. But at the same time, I think more often than not, we're just discovering the same elemental structure that they discovered.
I agree with that.
David, you had a sort of
Yeah, no, I'm tripping on it.
Well, it goes back to that whole thing with in 1970 or whatever, after 2001 was released to the world, and if you hadn't seen it, you at least knew somebody who had seen it. And I probably generated more abstract thought and thinking conversation than anything in the world at that time. You know, there was a certain mental frequency necessary to discuss it. And because it was global, it manifested itself in the collective consciousness faster and greater than anything had ever done before it. So it occupied a place in human, in the human experience or the human evolution, with the spike of a drug. You know, it just, everywhere and anywhere at any point in time, you could be three conversations away from bringing up 2001.
Did you know that John Lennon donated a bunch of money for people who couldn't afford to see 2001 to go see 2001? Jesus. And is quoted as a saying that 2001 A Space Odyssey should be shown in a cathedral every day?
God.
It's true.
I was having this discussion with someone about Tree of Life, about how that movie, really, people really strongly rejected that. And, you know, there were the obvious comparisons to 2001, but I thought most of the comparisons were lazy comparisons, that they were just superficial comparisons because of the imagery, because of the pacing. I really felt that no reviewer really captured just exactly why it is a, should be mentioned in the same breath as 2001. And I think we touched upon this in our conversation last time, David, that in essence, it's a film, it's a hieroglyphic film, mm-hmm. right? And it's, to me, it's almost as if the film is poured into your brain. It's not laser beamed into your brain, that it engages different parts of the brain. And unless you regularly utilize those places in your brain, you're going to reject it. Much in the same way you put Finnegan's Wake in front of somebody, certain people can read 20 pages of it, certain people can't even make five sentences into it. I even know people who walked out of Tree of Life, which to me just seems absurd. That they walk into a movie theater and 30 minutes in they had to leave. I don't know why that would be, but it created such a strong emotional or physical reaction that they had to leave the room. And you're talking about something that is, even just on the surface, beautiful. I don't know why you wouldn't want to look at something beautiful for 2 hours. But it just created a chemical reaction of boredom that they said, I'm being confined right now. I need to leave. So,
well, you compared it to a drug, and I've known a lot of people who, you know, on LSD couldn't look at a mirror.
Yep.
And it seems to me that if it did have this sort of drug effect, that that could be why people are repulsed. They're like, oh, I don't want to look at the structure of the universe. I don't right. see myself in there.
Yeah, totally.
I might see that I'm the monster I'm fighting, as we said before. And then even from a this conspiracy point of view of people saying it's like mind control, you know, this, why would... You know, you can't see it. Well, John Lennon's going to give you money so you can see it. We just want you to see this movie or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Any conspiracy point of view you might throw on it, ultimately what I think is that, you know, there was the old LSD tests and the army wanted to use LSD to control people. And then they quickly realized that people, after taking LSD, didn't want to be in the army. And it's like, wow, okay, this doesn't work. So it would seem to me that even using brainwashing propaganda in movies, which I have no doubt does occur, just, again, being a student of history, propaganda is a very real thing. But nonetheless, there would be a some sort of backlash, I would think, that you're trying to induce one state in people, but you could very easily induce another state. You could, if people look through it, they're going to find that true reflection.
Right. So I was realizing how funny it is that every time I would say, not every time, but many times I would say Albert Hoffman, people would think I was talking about Abby Hoffman.
Yeah.
Especially people who are older. And I'd be talking about Abby Hoffman. They're like, you mean Albert Hoffman? And I was like, recently I was like, huh, Albert and Abby Hoffman, both in terms, like, one discovers the fucking thing, and the other one knows what to do with it. And, like, how interesting that is, like, just in terms of the government, like, Albert Hoffman had nothing to do with MKUltra. He gave LSD to Nazi sympathizers who all, for the most part, rejected the ideology and was like, wow, this is fucking crazy, you know? And Abby Hoffman was a total revolutionary. The last thing that the government wanted to see come out of what they expected to see be the result of LSD, which is a bunch of people not caring what the fuck the government was doing and having no ability to focus on anything beyond a tree, you know? And so it's interesting because they're like, oh, fuck, you got a revolutionary on the shit, and he's very organized, and this isn't what we had hoped for, and so it seems, like, really appropriate. It's like, I don't know. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, you unleash the genie on the world, but once it's out of the bottle, it's not in your control anymore.
Right, where that was the first thing I fucking thought of this morning, for whatever reason. I'm laying in bed thinking about Robin Williams in Aladdin. It was like the first thing that arose in my mind, and then I was like remembering that genie, from its root, is the same etymology as genius. And that the original meaning of genie isn't like just simply as we take it today, this kind of limited like idea of like a wish granter, but actually that comes out of a lamp. But that the lamp is actually our head, that the genie is our higher self. He's like the hierophant. And that's the original meaning of genie. Later, we have these other attributions to it, you know. But in the first place, it's us. It's part of ourselves. And that to be in touch with that higher self is genius. So, yeah.
You know, even the idea of people who take it as the jinn, the Islamic idea of the jinn, as this sort of demonic spirit, you could just as easily take that demon to be a daemon, the idea of that higher self, the same thing.
Right.
And look at how Robin Williams is a blue genie, very Krishna-like, you know, that higher enlightened blue being.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it's funny that he... just the sort of Mickey Mouse connection. I don't know. I just went back in my head to the end of Full Metal Jacket. Sorry.
Well,
it ends with Mickey Mouse.
Uh huh.
AI, Robin Williams is the Albert Einstein computer genie, right? When they go to.
Oh, that's right. And then he's in Bicentennial Man. Yeah, that's weird.
Well, David, the little robot boy, has all these questions that no one can answer, right? So he goes to this room and he gets these credits and he can ask these questions. And this little Albert Einstein holographic projection comes out. But really all he's doing in that scene is accessing the internet.
Isn't that Dr. No?
Yes.
Dr. No, yeah.
Dr. Who? I mean, Dr. No.
Every time we log on to the internet, aren't we rubbing the lamp of...
Yes.
And every time
if you got a laptop, you're
we
looking
ask
at a little,
them, oh, hey, if you do this, it delivers the information to us. But this is a genie of our own creation.
Yes.
This is not some sort of metaphysical or supernatural or discovered in a wayward place. We've actually created our own. Everything we get back from the computer is human. It comes from a human source.
It's mm-hmm. a literal reflection.
Yeah. That was also the Mogwai. I was curious of what Mogwai meant in reference to Gizmo, right, and Gremlins. And I think I may have talked to you about this, Alan, in one of our last conversations, but that Mogwai translates as demon from Chinese. And I thought it was interesting that the Gremlins are in these cocoons, right, before they go through the pupal stage before they... you know, become gremlins or whatever, and how interesting that is, and also in terms of Kleepo, considering that at the beginning too, and when they're watching the television with what's his name, fucking the Lost Boys, one of the Frog Twins, Corman or whatever, what is his name, Billy, what the fuck, it's the kid, and there's Billy and then his friend, but Corey Feldman, and they're watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and they're like, these pods, and they come out of these pods, and this whole thing, which is a foreshadowing of what happens later in the film, you know, but yeah, I don't know.
It's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I believe.
Yeah, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, yeah. And so it's funny, like, that they come out of these pods, and then the gremlins come out of these pods, and that the meaning of Kleepo as shell or husk, and the chalice is also, like, this pod, you know? And that that Mogwai literally means demon. And so I don't know. And you basically, if you know how to be with your demon in the appropriate way, and you take care of them, and you keep them out of the fucking sunlight, and you don't feed them after midnight, and you don't get water on them, everything's groovy, you know? But then if you don't know how to take care of a demon, then it turns into a demon, you know? As we'd expect a demon to look like, not a cute, fuzzy little guy like you could be,